shell. And it was a 20 millimeter incendiary shell that had not gone off. The incendiary, for some reason, the bullet had failed.
Okay.
And of course, if it had gone off and gone through any one of the tanks, it would have exploded the tank, and then that would have been it. But again, as they took this shell out and took it into the armories, they were defusing it, and I'm damned if it didn't go off and take the boy's hand off, the armorer who was defusing it in the armament section, and it blew his hand off as when he was taken off. And there it was. Just one of those incredible things. This is the kind of thing that happened, which made you sort of feel, well, your number just wasn't up. That's all it was to it.
You didn't ripple the aircraft.
No, it didn't. No. I learned my lesson on that one, because the chances of losing all your wing surface were pretty great when you'd done that, because you popped a whole pile of rivets, and a bit more stressing, and you just rip all the sheets. He would just rip right off the top of your wing. So you had to be. I learned my lesson on that one. And, of course, once we'd gone into the dive, in that case, Jimmy was pretty sure we'd lost him. He probably thought he'd shot us down.
Yeah.
And he didn't follow us down. So that once I knew he wasn't following us down, then it was a question of easing out of the dive I was in as soon as we got near the cloud. And that's what I did. And I know I was very conscious of not ripping the wings. Cause that other one had happened earlier, so I didn't want to do that.
I think that your other gunners, your midsection upper and lower,
couldn't do it because he was always below, to the rear and below, and there was nothing they could do. The mid upper gunner was really almost a waste of time. The only time a mid upper would come into play was if you were in a daylight raid and the fighters were coming in from above.
Yeah.
Night fighters, day fighters coming in from above. Night fighters always came in from below because that was the most vulnerable spot for the. To the point where the 88, the JU-88, where they developed the installation of two 20-millimeter cannons in an almost vertical position behind the pilot. Just a slight angle forward from the vertical. And the 88, when he saw a bomber, he would then literally just pull up and formate below the bomber, just formate below him, until he was directly beneath him. And then, at the right angle, he had a little sight, which was a Heath Robinish sight. But it was not all he had to do was just look up, and if the center of the airplane was in his sight, then he just pressed the tip, and of course, the 20-millimeter shell just went right through the middle of the airplane, and that was it. That became dangerous, because quite often they hit the bombs, and the bombs exploded. Developed the technique to where, instead of being right under the airplane, they get under one of the wings. I'm only talking about 15, 20 feet. It shows you how accurate they were. And then when he pressed the button, he'd hit the fuel tank.
Yeah.
So she'd explode. And he'd have enough time to get out without a great big explosion of the bomb. So the technique was, for the night fighters, was definitely a stern and below type of attack. And so your front gunner and your tail gunner. And your front gunner, the only time your front gunner was any good, I remember one raid, I guess it must have been a raid to Berlin, we came back across, the return trip was across Denmark. And it was a beautiful night. And we were pretty sure there was no ack-ack and no trouble. And all of a sudden, I saw a great big clearing ahead, and we were low. By low, I think we were down around 500 to 1,000 feet. It was just a beautiful night, and you could see for miles. Clear night and great big moon. And I was sure there was this clearing was a runway, at least an airfield coming up. So I said to my front gunner, at least my engineer, to get in the front turret quickly. And I warned Jimmy Scannell in the tail. I thought we were coming up on an airfield. And I said, it's up to you, boys. I can't change course now. We're going to go over it. But if you see anything, shoot it. Well, God, we went down and our airplane sparked all down. And geez, they had great fun. We were scooting across this airfield. They just opened up with everything and sprayed every gun and aircraft they could see on this field. And of course, we were across it in the way before there was any alert sound or anything like that. And it was great fun.
Yeah.
But that didn't happen very often. And you had that kind of I suppose they might have gotten us with light ack-ack, but it was, you just sort of gritted your teeth and you went in and you just hoped and prayed that they weren't ready for you. And that was it. And that's exactly what happened. We didn't get a shot fired back at us at
could
all.
You see any results?
No, we couldn't see any results, but we told them about it, and whether there was a follow-up on or not. Oh, there was no, we hit airplanes. There was no question about that. We did some damage, but we never did know. No, it's just a question of just keeping, as far as the tail gunner was concerned, the way we done, he just kept his finger on the tip and kept firing all the way until we got across the other side of the
airplane. Great.
It was the only opportunity I think we ever had to fire back at those things on the ground in anger and shoot back.
Yeah. But it must have been damn difficult, Reg, to spot those damn light fighters.
It was. Yeah, that was the trouble. Now, I remember a few minutes ago I outlined the change in the evasive tactics that were used, where instead of throwing the airplane around, you would sort of change course every 20 seconds. Because, again, when the night fighters came along, that became a very dangerous technique, because for that very reason, that you were, instead of flying all over the bloody sky, throwing the airplane all over the sky, you were flying straight and level, just minor alterations in course that had been flung. And that was where the night fighter had all the time in the world to come up in your blind spot and wait until you've gone through a turn, and he'd just stay with you in formation, below in formation, until you finished a turn, and you were flying straight and level, and then finish you off at that time. So that was realized. And then the defensive tactic for that was that when you made a turn, and perhaps once a minute, or once every 2 minutes, when you made a turn, you'd turn the airplane right on its side, just so everybody, and you'd warn your crew, which your gunners, which side it was going to be, so they'd be ready, and they would look down. You'd do it literally a very steep turn, right into a very, very steep turn. And the idea being to see if there was anything below you, and it was what you did. And then you wouldn't change course very much to do that. I mean, literally, it was done that quickly. You'd go into a break quickly, throw into the airplane on its side, and then back again, so that you wouldn't get too far off track, nor lose altitude. When you try to throw an airplane like that loaded, you lose a lot of altitude. So quickly, on the side, and then back again. But it was, if all the crew were looking, it was long enough to see if there was anything below you. So that became the defensive tactic against that. But even that, a good night fighter, some of those night fighter pilots became just superb. The hell, they could pick out a bomber, and within 15 or 20 seconds, they'd have that airplane down. And some of those night fighter pilots had incredible number of kills during the war. Some incredible numbers.
Did you ever meet any after the war?
No. I suppose I did. I met Steinhoff, but he wasn't so much a night fighter as Steinhoff, as he was a day fighter. I don't suppose I ever really met any of the night fighter pilots. Germans were very sensitive. It seemed that every time I met somebody, a German, during the days of NATO when I was overseas, they always fought on the Eastern Front. And I have an album which was made up when I left the Air Division. And one of those albums with the humorous captions.
Yeah.
And one of them shows my chief of staff, Tommy Thompson. Shaking hands with Prince Ludwig von Baden, one of the two princes, brothers at Baden-Baden, who were what, nephews of the prince. And the caption, they're shaking hands, and the caption with the prince with a very serious look on his face, and Tommy with a smile, the caption is, "No, Prince, I fought on the Eastern Front." So, of course, it came a little bit later, and you met somebody say, "No, I fought on the Eastern Front." Well, I guess raid was my first real tangle with a night fighter, and so from there on in, we were very sensitive. I'd learned to be sensitive to ripple wings, and now I was very, very conscious of night fighters because we had a bad tangle. Then, I suppose, just two other raids I might mention. One was a trip to Italy, to Milan, and that was a long haul. Milan was a long way, but we went to Milan, and I can remember there was cloud over Milan. I decided that the Italian defenses couldn't be anything like they were, the German defenses, and they weren't. That, hell, it would be worthwhile letting down into this cloud. And again, it was one of the silly things to do, but I guess it was the old press-on attitude. You let down to a height where you thought it would be, you wouldn't go any further. In other words, what was the altitude of the hills around? And if you're pretty sure of where you were, you could let down to a minimum altitude, and if you were in the clear, okay. If not, you climb back up again, and then do a bombing run and drop your bombs through the clouds. In this case, we let down, and God, we came out below the cloud, and dropped some flares, and boy, there we were, right over Milan, and there wasn't a shot being fired in anger, and so we bombed. I forget what the point was, probably the main railway station, mm-hmm. something like that. Anyway, we dropped our bombs and headed back. And it was on that raid that Robinson, who was the squadron commander, had taken the crew of a lad who was sick, one of the other crews. And he was hit on that raid. He got hit by some light ACAC, and the fire started in his flares. And he bailed the crew up over Italy. The fire went out, and he flew that airplane back to England, using the navigator's log, flight plan, landed way down in Wales, way, way, way off course, but nevertheless got back to England, and was all by himself, no one else in the airplane.
He couldn't contact anyone else on the raid itself?
He couldn't...
Or, sorry, he couldn't contact any other planes on the raid itself?
No, because we had not developed any technique for communication at that time. No, he was on... And a bomber raid, you were on your own from the moment you took off. The only thing that would happen was that you might talk to the master bomber. But no, you were on, there was no way of helping one another. Unless you, by sheer chance, happened to see somebody in trouble, and you might pour mate on them and try and contact them. But we had no common frequency. There was no way of talking one airplane to another. The technique was never developed. It was a question of you, boy, you were on your tod right from the minute you took off until you got back to base. Sometimes you could use hand signals. I form eight on the airplanes that were in trouble until they got across the coast, just to make sure that if they were navigating. And by use of hand signals, just to make sure that they were headed towards one of the main emergency fields. They built emergency fields along the east coast of England. There were about three of them, four of them, and they were great big long, about 10,000 foot runways, with all kinds of emergency gear on them, and they were there solely for somebody who was in real trouble. He might even be flying on one engine and losing height, but make it, and he'd land with his gear up, just get on the ground. He didn't have to worry about hitting anything. If he could get on the end of the runway, he may not have any brakes. They have no hydraulics. He could run forever, and he would still stop. Then they would very quickly just bulldoze the airplane, literally tow it right off the strip, because there could be another airplane coming in right behind. And they were emergency vehicles, and quite often from it and make sure they were heading in the right direction, and then leave them to their own and head back. Then the other raid in that second one was the last one of that tour, and I had by this time picked up a sort of a scratch crew of people who were all finishing off. It seemed very seldom that a crew all finished their tour together. There was always somebody being sick and had missed a couple of raids or had been, something had happened. Mm-hmm. So you always had those odd bodies, mm-hmm. who had perhaps one trip to go or two trips to go when their particular captain had finished. And I, at the end of my second tour, my crew had pretty well, I had lost some of my crew who was being screened. And so I was picking up odds and sods and making up crews. And one of them I picked up on this particular trip was a boy who had one trip to go, Bob Trickett. He was a Canadian, Bob Trickett. And it was a long raid. It was the Pilsen Works, the Skoda Works in Pilsen, in Czechoslovakia, which was the longest raid. Pretty well, I had been on at that time, so it took us 8 hours and 25 minutes to do that trip. And Bob Trickett, it was, again, rather like the Milan raid. We got to the target, it was overcast. So again, we let down, and when we got below, we did come below cloud. We were very low. If you remember, we were down something about 1,000 feet. And industrial haze, real industrial haze. God, couldn't see a thing. It was smog. Then we dropped some flares, and we saw the works. And so we did drop our, we had target markers. Mm-hmm. We dropped our markers and our bombs, but it would have been very ineffective, because I doubt very much if anybody else had gone down below the rate. I never did bother to check, but I don't think many people would have gone down below the cloud. But we then headed back. That was one of those nights when there had been two main raids. The main raid was on Pilsen, and there was another main raid on Karlsruhe. And our trip back, our route back, was just south of Karlsruhe. So I said to Bob Trickett, my navigator, I said, Bob, let's just go back once we got out of Pilsen, and we hadn't had any trouble, hadn't been shot at anyone. I said, let's just go a little bit north of track, and let's see how the raid is going at Karlsruhe, because we would be able to give a report when we get back. If it's clear, we can see it. It had been clear on the way out. The cloud layer didn't really start to build up until we got almost just come back in. So we were steaming along, and the cloud formation was coming, it had been spreading or forming, and Bob was using the navigation data from the H2S given to him by the set operator. And Michael Mack said, you know, we're getting awfully close to Carlson. So Bob said, that's okay. We should get a good look. All of a sudden, the cloud finished. It was just a sheer wall of cloud, and it finished. And there, and it was very thick cloud. It was a front. It was probably a cold front. And there, by Jesus, there was Carlson. Where were we? Right over Carlson. And again, the same thing happened. Here we were, not where we should have been, and being the only airplane, the other raid had finished long before, and everybody had gone home. And here we were, over the bloody Karlsruhe, all by ourselves, with no bombs on board, nothing. And, of course, the same thing. God, we were clamped in the searchlight, and the PAC-X started up. And I can remember saying, trick it, USOB. What kind of navigation is that? You put us over, Carlsruhe. I said, I want to get near it, not over it. Well, again, same procedure. I just did the airplane on its nose. And we came out over the Rhine. We could see the Rhine River quite clearly. When we came across the Rhine River at about 1,000 feet, going by Kell. And again, escaped. We escaped, because I was ready for it. I suppose your reaction was, by that time, I now had, 45 trips. And your reaction to be ready for anything. And of course, as soon as the cloud came in, I saw the target. I knew right away, quick, that we were in trouble. And I reacted immediately to get loose height, to get the hell out. But for that reason, although they were shooting at us, they were always behind us, behind us and above us. Yeah. And I don't think we even picked up any damage. But it was still a bit hairy all of a sudden to find yourself over a target all by yourself when you really shouldn't have been there. And I said, and my other finally parting words to Bob Trickett was, and Bob, this is your and my last trip, and you bled and your got us killed. needlessly.
Yeah.
Well, that was it. We did get back, and Karlsruhe had been a good way. We were able to give a pretty accurate story as to what was going on at Karlsruhe, much more than we were able to tell about Pilsen, which had been the scuttle works, which had been our primary target. Well, now that was that perhaps covers it. The up to the end of my second tour with the Pathfinders on Halifaxes, being on Halifaxes all that time, and by that time I'd done 45 trips. Now, I should explain, the normal tour was 30 operations.
Mm-hmm.
But if you, in Pathfinders, because of the loss rate and the danger involved in Pathfinders, they decreed that 45 trips done right the whole way through would constitute two tours of operation.
Oh, yeah.
And it was nothing more than an attempt to, I suppose if anybody stayed much longer, the chances of actually finishing the tour were pretty well nil.
Mm-hmm.
Being the first over the target, and pathfinders were always the first to hit target, and you were always the first ones to be predicted, and therefore your chances of getting shot down were pretty good. And similarly, on the way back, any night fighters would have known what the target was, and they'd be already into the stream, and they'd try and get into the head of the stream and start picking off, because they did try to go after the pathfinder force. They knew where the pathfinders were, the leaders, and where the experience was. Mm-hmm. So the pathfinders were diligently picked on. And losses were creeping up. I don't remember any bad nights on during that, either my first or the second tour, a bad loss night, other than the ones I've mentioned, such as the Trondheim raid and the Daylight Sunburst. Those stand out in my mind. The others, yes, we lost airplanes, crews, and lost here and there, and so forth, but I don't remember any one bad night in the squadron, as what happened when I got on my third tour. Although, as I say, I mean, we would lose two airplanes or something like that, but that would be it. Well, now, when I finished there, Pathfinders had formed, or 8th Group had formed, a special navigation training unit. It was called the PFFNTU, the Pathfinder Force Navigation Training Unit. And it was like a super operational training unit. Crews that were to go into the squadrons were now sent to this navigation training unit. Now, I'm talking about crews with 12 or 15 trips. They're experienced crews. And there, they were put through the mill of the Pathfinder technique. And the staff, as I was, we would fly with these crews, and we would do cross-country. We would watch how the crew operated. We would check their navigation. Then they would be simulated raids with the various techniques and various operational techniques that Pathfinder used. We would throw this at them in the briefing, and then they'd go off and do this cross-country. And then when we got on the ground, we would sit down, the instructor would sit down with the crew and critique the whole operation, the things that he had not done. And the navigator would throw in certain things. The instructor would throw in such things, such as he would come on as if, as a tail gunner would, night fighter coming in, prepared to turn starboard, to go. He would throw that sort of stuff in. Mind you, they were all briefed. The crew was briefed to be ready for anything that the instructor could throw in anything at any moment, and if something came up, the pilot was to react as if it was coming from his own crew. So you would check them out and see what happened on that. The experience you had gained, you were trying to pass on to these still relatively inexperienced crews when you think in terms of their only partner through their first tour. And then after, if they passed, and they did not all pass, sometimes the groups would be inclined not to send down their best crews, so they'd want to keep some of them back to be flight commanders and squadron commanders. And sometimes, because they had to provide a crew, the squadron losses were such that they had to provide crews, sometimes they'd try and slip in a ropey crew. Well, of course, that ropey crew wouldn't get through the navigation training. That crew would be sent back to the group. And then the AOC of Pathfinder Force would phone the group commander and say, come on now, you try to slip one over on us, and you know damn well we can't operate that way. So it became not only a super training unit, it also became a screening to make sure that good crews were going to get into the squadron. And that was sort of great fun, because it was not like an operational training. You weren't sitting in the right-hand seat training pilot sat up to have an airplane or like that. You were flying with experienced people and giving them the benefit of your own experience. And so it was great fun. Now, that lasted until, let's see, I did my last operation on the 16th of April, which was Pilsen, and then I was
transferred.
1943.
Yeah.
Yes, and I just noticed here that when you were transferred, the squadron commander, they put a form, I see it's form 414A, an RAF form. And it's entitled Summary of Flying and Assessment on Posting. And I see for the first time that the squadron commander of 35 Squadron, who by that time was a boy by the name of Dean, had assessment of ability as a heavy bomber pilot, exceptional. Now, the reason for being exceptional was the fact that I survived 45 raids. And that's why anybody who survived 45 trips was exceptional.
Yeah, lovely.
It was pure odds. Well, that went on in 1943 until July. Now, in July of 1943, we had the Canadian-built Lancasters beginning to show up, or at Malton, in Toronto, the Victory Aircraft were building Lancaster bombers. And I was selected, by London, by Air Force, RCF headquarters in London. Anyway, I was selected along with a motley group of the other crew members to go back to Canada. To be the crew to fly the first Canadian-built Lancaster back to England.
I think what we'll do right is stop it right there. Again, do you have a question?
Yeah, well, you're a squadron leader this time, and you've also neglected to mention the DSO. Which
that's true. By that time, I had become a squadron, a flight commander in 35 Squadron. It was really a question of survival, and the longer you survived, of course, the faster the promotion or the heavier the losses. Yes, I took over sea flight in 35 Squadron in January of 43 as a squadron leader, and then after I'd finished my tour, as a matter of fact, they knew right away, I suppose it was after my last trip, the Times used to come out, I guess it was on almost a weekly basis, for the list of decorations. And also those who were missing in casualties and so forth, the London Times.
Mm-hmm.
And Dean, who was on the squadron commander, said, I think you better watch the paper. And of course, I knew right away quick. He was inferring that I was up for another decoration, although he didn't tell me what. And sure enough, that week in the paper, there I was, I had received the DSO. So I had the DSO before I actually left 35 Squadron. I was able to wear the ribbon in the last few days I was with the squadron. So I went to the navigation training unit with the DSO and the DFC at that time.
And you would be, how old would you be that time? Right?
Well, in 43, I was 23.
Good Lord.
That time. 23.
I think Chris wants another war, so he can get a couple of himself.
No.
Oh, no.